Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life is songs of grief with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. He's temper all the times I've
arrived. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer dude and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
Well, I didn't also add to my different honorific hairs or whatever those are called. The honorific things you say at the beginning.
Horrific?
Maybe horrific. The different titles, I guess, or whatever. My other title would be, I have a bye in the first round of my fantasy football league because of my stellar record this year.
Well, I don't even think I made it to the playoffs. I stunk it up. But it's all Christian McCaffrey's fault for being injured all year.
If you don't know if you made it to the playoffs, then I'm guessing you didn't.
No, I don't think so. It's all his fault. He did it to me.
I'm the odds-on favorite to win, but I'm a little nervous that I'm not going to pull through at the very end with the last couple of games. So
that happened to me a few years back. I think I had like a one-loss season, and then got to the playoffs, and like my stars that had gotten me there, like they were all injured or they didn't play because they had it so wrapped up or whatever, So I ended up like losing in the first round.
Yeah, well, I can't lose in the first round because I have a bye, so we got that going for
us. Well, we didn't have any byes.
There's no easy way. Back in my day, we walked uphill both ways to the fantasy football championship.
That's right.
So this episode was suggested by one of our listeners on the court-appointed Facebook page. It was Jake Peterson, was it not?
I believe that's correct.
I believe so. Indubitably.
Indubitably.
He recommended that we talk about the Federal Employers Liability Act, also known as FELA, I guess.
Yep, FELA.
And how that has to do with protecting railroad workers from injuries on the job. And it just so happens that we have a former railroad worker on this podcast.
Right. Just as it's come up before, like when you've asked me about being familiar with OSHA, since I work for the railroad, and I said, well, no, actually, the railroad has their own FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, that takes care of it instead of OSHA. And then how about Social Security? No, I wouldn't get Social Security with that. Railroaders pay into railroad retirement. They have their own retirement. Same way with workers' comp claims. They have their own workers' comp, and it operates under FELA.
Workers' clomp is what you get when you get clomped on the head.
Yeah. That happened to me a lot. That's why I talk that way.
But yeah, so FELA is the railroad equivalent to workers' compensation. Now, there are some differences, which I want to get into later on when we kind of talk about other kinds of federal workers' compensation that's out there and state workers' compensation for that matter. But for the purposes of the opening here, we're going to talk about FELA. So FELA is a federal law. It was enacted, the current iteration of it was enacted in 1908 to protect railroad workers who were injured on the job. So under FELA, if an injured railroader can prove that the railroad was at least partially negligent in causing an injury, they're entitled to recover for their damages. Now, when FELA was enacted, there was no remedy in place for workers who were injured on the railroad. So this was a kind of a very important step for them to get some sort of coverage. Now, I say it was enacted in 1908 because it was first enacted in 1906. And that law went up to the Supreme Court and was struck down as unconstitutional. So Congress promptly 2 years later enacted the 1908 version, which passed Supreme Court muster.
Yeah, they learned from their mistakes in the 1906 version and changed it in 1908. And the reason being is that workers' comp was just not sufficient to impact the railroad to make them change what they were doing and make it safer, because workers' comp was basically an insurance you were buying. And then all they could recover for the most part is your like your medical bills and maybe lost wages and stuff like that. And that was not causing enough pain to the railroad to make them want to change.
In 1889, the Interstate Commerce Commission started compiling statistics on occupational injuries on the railroad. And these surveys showed that in the previous year, one in every 35 railroad employees was injured. One of every 357 workers was killed. So that's a very, very high percentage if you think about it. One in 35 or one in 357?
Absolutely.
I'd like those odds to play the lottery.
Yeah.
But not the railroad lottery as it was back then.
Well, that's what we used to call FILA, was the railroad lottery.
Was it really?
Yeah. Yeah, as I guess. Well, that guy took a chance on getting injured and playing that game and not getting fired and trying to get a big chunk of money from the railroad. You know,
the Interstate Commerce Commission did govern the railroads until 1995, when it was abolished and it's folded into the National Surface Transportation Board. So that's the new regulatory agency which oversees the railroads. So as you said, around the turn of the century, based on those statistics from 1889, that it was clear that railroad owners needed some sort of incentive to focus on the safety for their workers. And the workers needed extra compensation and protection. And that's kind of how this all came to fruition.
Yeah, according to the data contained in the Interstate Commerce Commission accident bulletins from 1902 to 1911, over that 9-year period, a total of 33,761 employees and 4,146 passengers were killed. And then another 403,259 employees and 113,410 passengers were injured.
Yeah.
So there's 500,000 people, employees and passengers, that were injured, not counting the, what was it, about 37,000-38,000 people that were killed.
I think I know why those numbers were so high.
Why is that?
Because Casey Jones was driving that train high on cocaine.
Okay, well, that's would make him part of the Grateful Dead.
But those numbers that's outlandish. That is, I can't even comprehend that it was 33,000 some that were killed.
Yeah. Yeah. You had you would have about anywhere from the high 2000s to the low 4000s killed a year working on the railroad.
I wonder what percentage of workers that actually was, how many were actually employed. I mean, it's got to be a pretty significant number.
It was about 3%, 3 to 3.5%. And the worst year they had was in 1906, and it reached almost 4%. It was 3.9.
Wow.
So 4 out of every 100 people working for the railroad were going to get killed that year. And you had about 1.5 million people working for the railroad.
Yeah.
Now that's all railroads over the whole country.
So the main difference between FILA and workers' compensation, as you might understand workers' compensation, has to do with our one old friend called negligence. Now, when you have traditional state-based workers' compensation claims, negligence really doesn't play an issue. Even if the worker was negligent in their own right, it doesn't matter. They were on the job, they got hurt, they get benefits, they get coverage.
Right.
So, you know, it's, you know, black and white. Now, there are some different things in there. If you intentionally tried to hurt yourself, then that might be a bar to recovery under workers' compensation. But for the most part, if you get hurt on the job, regardless of what happened under a workers' compensation system, you get coverage. It's a no-fault-based type system. FILA, however, is a system wherein the worker can recover damages if there was some sort of negligence on behalf of the railroad. Now, the trade-off is that in the workers' compensation case, workers' compensation cases, they can only claim limited types of damages, which are generally related to just their medical expenses, and they don't get any kind of pain and suffering or anything like that. Under FILA, however, the injured employee, if they show negligence for the employer or that the employer failed to provide a reasonably safe workplace, then they can recover extra damages, more so than what they're just their medical bills. They can recover extra things like pain and suffering and things like that. So it's a bit higher standard, the reward is a bit greater.
Yeah, future earnings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this the greater financial deficit that it caused the railroad is one of several acts that came about to try to force the railroads to be safer, including the Federal Liability Act, were adopted. One was the Accident Reports Act of 1900. That meant that the railroad had to report all accidents to the government, because up to that time, they didn't have to say anything to anybody, so there was no records for anybody to follow. Another one that was a big one was the Hours of Service Act. What the Hours of Service Act did is it said that before, people might work 24, 48 hours at a time. And of course, what are tired employees going to do? They're going to be subject to accidents. So they enacted at the time a 16-hour max that you could work consecutively. Now that has been reduced to 12.
Yeah, well,
employee cannot work more than 12.
16 hours seems a little excessive.
It does. Yeah, and they reduced that down to 12 later on. And when you reached hours of service, it doesn't matter where you're at. If you reach 12 hours, you stop your train wherever you're at and secure it and leave it.
Yeah.
You cannot operate past that time. Another one that was big, now this was back in the steam train days, it was the Ashpan Act, which meant that it prohibited the use of locomotives equipped with ashpans that could not be dumped without employees going under the locomotive for that purpose.
Wow, while it was traveling?
Well, no, not while it was traveling, but even at that, anytime you've got a situation where you're putting people under live trains, something bad can happen.
Right, because it could start moving. I mean, after all, it is on wheels.
Right. Then another one was the Safety Appliances Act, and that standardized brake systems, handholds, and things like automatic couplers, because before, you had to physically close a coupler with your bare or gloved hand, close a coupler, and most guys on the railroad could be identified because they were missing one or more fingers from doing that. So they had to develop automatic couplers that coupled together when they met. So one of the others was transportation of explosives and hazardous materials. That was another one where they had to standardize that because people were just loading most any kind of thing and having all kinds of problems. So a lot of this seems like common sense, but these are all things that in the wild, wild west, when the railroad was being born, weren't being taken advantage of. And the railroad, the other thing they didn't really care about is a lot of times, a lot of their workers building the tracks were immigrants.
Yeah.
You had large Irish contingencies that were building the tracks. You had large Chinese contingencies, and then also African Americans. And they were looked at as, well, if they die, just push them out of the way and get another one.
Yeah.
I mean, that was about the way they treated it. If you ever seen the beginning of Blazing Saddles?
I was just about to say that. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's not too far from the truth. That's a little bit over the top, but it wasn't too far from the truth.
Yeah, sadly. Now, the reason that the federal government can regulate the railroads like this is because one of our old friends. But I think before we talk about our old friend, we might have another old friend that's going to have a motion today before the court.
Why, yes, if it pleases your conductorship, we would like to approach the bench to pay for court costs. Woo, woo!
All aboard. Who do we have on the who do we have on the train station?
Docket
today.
We have our good friends at BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals?
I would say so. I think this entire pandemic is doing that.
I would agree.
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can start communicating in under 48 hours.
It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide.
And you can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily.
Visit betterhelp.com/court, that's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states.
And there's a special offer for court-appointed listeners. You'll get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/court.
That's right. All court-appointed listeners get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/court. Mike and Tommy want you to get BetterHelp today.
So now, I mentioned before the break that there was an old friend that was out there that gave the federal government the authority to pass laws that dealt with the railroad. Do you know what that old friend might be?
It wasn't Collis P., was it?
No, it was not Collis P. When I say old friend, I'm not actually referring to a person, so to speak, but more
of the Interstate Commerce Act.
That's right, because ordinarily the Congress would not be able to come in and pass these laws unless there was some specific grant of power that allowed them to do so. And that grant of power would be through the Commerce Clause, because certainly railroads deal with interstate commerce, so that gives the authority for Congress and the federal government to step in and start passing laws about it.
Well, speaking of Commerce Clause, that's a very timely time to talk about him at this time of year.
It is. That was always one of my favorite jokes from one of the early podcasts we did, early episodes of our podcast, rather. Commerce Clause was, what'd you say he was?
Santa's brother that took care of the money.
That's right. But the Commerce Clause, like all those different acts and things you talked about beforehand, that's what gives the federal government the authority to be able to regulate the railroads like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, the railway, they don't like all these different extra, I guess, laws that are passed regulating the way they do business and all this kind of things. So there are quite a few lobbying interests out there from the railroad that continue to challenge FILA in court. And they want them to actually repeal the law. They would rather it just be a regular negligence case as opposed to any kind of FILA system like this. But at this point, you know, I think the lobby for the workers is just as strong almost as the actual railroad itself. So it's probably unlikely that would ever happen.
Yeah, they get every once in a while they'll get up. I understand since it has been passed, which like you said was 1908, there have been 40 or 45 attempts where bills were introduced in Congress to revert the railroad back to standard workers' compensation. Every one of them has been defeated so far.
Now, without getting on a soapbox, I wonder who the donors were for those 45 or whatever Congress people that introduced those bills.
Well, that was probably people from the railroad industry that did, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure they were the lobbyists for the Congress people that introduced those. So
right. But the thing is, the proof was in the pudding because, you know, we talked about those stats of how many people were dying, and you had like 3,000 up to 4,500 a year in the early 1900s. Now, by about 20 years later, 1923 to 1931, you had like in 1923, you had 1,836 people killed. 1927, 1,395. 1929, 1269, but by 1931, you were down to 615.
Yeah, and I guarantee there were more workers working for the railroad at that point, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there absolutely were, because the railroads were continuing to grow. It's only been in recent times that the number of railroad workers has been cut back because, you know, a standard crew, that was another thing that added to it. A standard crew was five or six men on a train. Now a standard crew is one or two on a train, depending on what it does.
Yeah.
Usually you don't have any more than two people on it. So if that train did have a crash, instead of five or six people getting killed, it'd only be one or two now. But in comparison, those numbers now, like 2001, you had 20 fatalities over the whole railroad.
Yeah, it's rare.
And well, yeah, I mean, that's, you just don't have them as often. 19, as we're moving forward to 2019, you had 19, 23, 20, down to 15 in 2009, 16 in 2011, and getting up to 2018, you had 15, and 2019, you only had a total of 9 fatalities on the railroads throughout the whole United States for the whole year, So somewhere those rules are doing what they were put in there to do.
Now, I'm no math expert, but 9 is fewer than 33,000.
Yes, it's a few.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Take the ought and carry the ought. So it didn't have to be a dangerous business. It just, nobody really cared. They didn't have the incentive. Well, and that's what you got to do with a large corporation, is you got to give them incentive to want to change. And money is a large incentive.
Yeah, I mean, that's all we really have in our legal system, is money to try to compensate people or to try to deter people. But I think probably some of the technology was just a bit more dangerous back then too, regardless of whatever safeguards you might have tried to put into place. I think it's probably a little bit of the fact that technology was not really safe at that point, and also that they didn't really care. I think it was probably a perfect storm of that coming together. Whereas now I think that we have the ability to have technology which you can make things safe, and people tend to care more about human life. So we're kind of going in the other direction now, I think. At least I'd like to think so.
Well, they do. And you know, technology, though, costs money, whatever that technology is. And that's what the railroad has been resistant to. For example, there's been a technology that's been around. Now, I've been gone from the railroad for 17 years, but this technology was around for at least 10 years before I left, where it's an absolute block where no trains could ever run into each other. But you have to equip everything with this equipment for it to do it, and then satellites control it, and satellites can see if trains are on a conflicting course, and they would shut the trains down. They've had that technology, but nobody's wanted to go to the expense of putting it in.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of similar, too. If you think about something that's affected us here in Huntington is the Marshall plane crash. One of the things that were pretty critical was that our airport here in Huntington didn't have a glide scope at that point whenever the plane was coming in. And that was some technology that airports had, which kept planes from coming in too low. And our airport here didn't have it at the time. It was available. It just didn't have it. And there's some conjecture that if there had been a glide scope, that wouldn't have happened. I think it's probably fair to say it probably wouldn't have happened. So, you know, technology can improve our lives and make things a lot safer. And it's important to stay abreast of that, because that's really what we want to do, I think.
Absolutely.
Now, when you were working on the railroad, you had quite a bit of experience with FELA, did you not?
Oh, absolutely. Because everything that safety was number one priority. Now, when I first started with the railroad, I started when I was in college.
Not to interrupt you, but I just want everyone to know, we're delving into Tommy's train stories at this point.
So take them with a grain of salt. Is that what you're saying?
No, everybody loves Tommy's train stories.
They ask for them around Christmas time, so there you go.
They do. I was thinking, a model train set going around a Christmas tree. Well, let Tommy tell you about Tommy's training stories.
But when I started out, I was actually still in college, and I was working track work for the railroad. And safety to me at that point was non-existent, because I didn't know anything about what I was getting into. I just went out there. I was told to report to these camp cars. These were World War II troop transport cars.
Now, this would have been in the late 70s, right?
1976.
Okay.
And these were World War II troop transport cars that had, no air conditioning or anything. They were basically a wooden box with a sink and a toilet. And the toilet was like just over this tank that was a dry tank. There were no chemicals or nothing in it.
Oh, I'm sure that's
so all that
wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it just accumulated in there. As a matter of fact, the assistant cook had a big stick that he kept with him, and he'd go in and knock down the droppings so that you weren't sitting on somebody else's droppings when you went in to use the toilet.
I kind of envision they might just fall out the bottom of the trains that's moving along.
Well, it might have after they moved. But anyway, like, I showed up. I had never been on the railroad a day in my life, and I walked out there, and they stuck a tool in my hand, and they said, here's how you use it. Go to work. There was not one thing talk to me about safety or do this, don't do that. The only thing I knew is I had to keep my hard hat on. They gave you a hard hat and it said, wear your hard hat.
Yeah.
So you wore that and did it. But that first summer, we were working along one stretch, and it was like probably 90, 95 degrees out. And when you're on the tracks, it's hotter than that, because not to get into all the technical structure, but besides the two metal rails, you have the creosoted concrete or the creosoted ties.
Yeah.
That creosote's soaking up, coming up out of those with the heat. And then they're in we called ballast. It's, most people would call it rocks,
yeah.
But that's what holds the track in place, is all those rocks. Well, that adds another 10 or 15 degrees. So we're out there working over 100 degrees, and they never gave you any breaks. They just worked you.
I'll tell you what, creosote-soaked railroad timbers, when they get in the sun, they start smelling. That is a strong, strong scent.
Yeah, it is, and they're slick, too, when you're trying to walk. But there was another young guy, I mean, he probably a few years older than me at the time, but he was doing whatever task he was doing, and he collapsed, and he had a heat stroke. So they just kind of, a couple guys dragged him over in the bushes, and they poured water on him and gave him a drink until he came back around. And when he did, they didn't do anything for him but say, okay, good, you're awake, go back to work.
Dock that worker half a day's pay for sleeping on the job.
Yeah. So they put him back out there, and he lasted about 20 minutes and collapsed again. And this time they couldn't wake him up. Well, they didn't call an ambulance or anything. They just said, one of the foremen was like, oh, damn it, I'll take him to the hospital. So he loads him in his car in the back seat and drove off to the hospital. Well, the guy died later.
Oh, he died?
We never saw him again. Yeah, he died.
Oh, my gosh.
That was how much they cared about safety when I started out. Now, several years later, after I finished college and I went back and became a management trainee, and I went back, all you heard about was safety. So I'm not sure what happened in that period between there, or if maybe they just hadn't started practicing that, because that's the engineering department. And I spent all my time in my supervisory years in transportation,
mm-hmm.
So not engineering. But engineering, I observed plenty of their safety meetings, stuff like that, and they did go over all the safety things, you know, by the time I came back and was a supervisor there. But you practiced 24 hours a day. You were concerned with safety. Everything you did was how many days you worked without an injury and nobody getting hurt and stuff.
I remember that because when I came to visit your office when you worked here in Huntington for the railroad, sometimes we'd go and have lunch at the Pizza Hut all-you-can-eat buffet. It was always a
mm-hmm.
good time. Anyway, I'd come to your office or whatever, but when I pulled up, I'd see there'd be a sign on the outside. It'd be, you know, so many days without an accident. That was like a very important thing. They were really trying to stress that.
Yeah, and here's the thing. They took the stance that if somebody got hurt, it was either going to be that employee's fault or it was the supervisor's fault. So if I'm at home in bed at 3:00 in the morning and I got an employee out working in knee-deep snow and he slips and falls and hurts his ankle, that's my fault.
Right.
I've got to answer for that. Now, we would hold, every time somebody would get hurt, we would hold what we called an investigation, which was our own kind of trial. And one of the railroad supervisors would hold the trial. We would call other witnesses up, which would be other officers that supervise that particular employee. And basically what you're trying to do is put all the negligence on him, that he was responsible for his own injury. The person he had representing him was a union representative that would come in with him and kind of act as his lawyer, and they could call any other type of witnesses if they wanted. They were not allowed to bring in a lawyer except as an observer. And, you know, what it always came down to is you would say, did you comply with rule? And I used to know the numbers off the top of my head, but did you comply with rule 13? And I'd say yes. And then you'd read rule 13 that says you will walk without turning your ankle while you're walking and falling down and getting hurt. And so since they turned their ankle and fell down and get hurt, you'd say, how did you comply with this rule after reading it to them? Well, I followed it. Well, do you acknowledge that you did turn your ankle and get hurt? Yes. Okay. So at that point, you feel like, well, we've won this case.
That's some shady stuff.
I know. That's the way you would leave. But
that was just the preliminary investigation there, right? And then eventually there would be an actual claim filed where there'd be a jury trial and all that, right?
Right. Yeah. They had to file a claim if they wanted to pursue it. And in some respects, it was kind of like putting the cards on the table saying, here's what we got on you. Now, are you sure you want to go this route?
Yeah.
And then we, as a supervisor, we always felt we were at the deficit because with all that money dangling out there, the guy didn't have a whole lot to lose but to go after it, you know. And then the other thing is the claim agent, even though the claim agent worked for the railroad, to us, he was the enemy, because if he saw that other cases like this had been maybe a $50,000 settlement, and he thought this was real similar to one of those, and it'd be $50,000, if he could go to this guy and say, look, I'll give you $20,000 if you sign off on it and drop the claim. So he'd say, okay, and do it. Well, that still counted against us. We wanted him to be guilty of it himself, because if you sign off on it, that means we're accepting guilt, but only for $20,000 worth.
Yeah.
So as the supervisor, you lost out anyway.
That sounds a bit like a broken system, honestly.
It is. It is. I mean, grown adults should be responsible for themselves. Now, if the railroad is putting you in an unsafe situation, if they're telling you you've got to go and walk along this cliff that's 2 feet wide and there's a 50-foot sheer drop and you drop off that drop, well, the railroad puts you in that position.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't have to do that. But if you're just out performing ordinary duties and, you know, or you're going through the crew room and you walk into a door, whose fault is that? You walked into a door, but there's plenty of people that would then turn around and sue the railroad.
Well, I mean, was there proper lighting in that room when you walked into the door?
Absolutely.
Was the door wide enough? I mean, does it have the proper hinges on it? How high was the doorknob itself? I mean, was it abnormally low, abnormally high? I think there's lots of reasons.
You know, that did come up one time in an investigation I was in, was how high the doorknob was.
Did it really?
Yeah, that actually did come up in one.
Yeah, well, see, I'm on to something there. It's almost like I'm a lawyer.
But here was the thing. The guys knew they had you as a supervisor, and anything that happened, like, say, a light, was there a proficient light? If a light bulb burned out, they would come in and say, hey, that light's out in there. That's a dangerous situation. And you knew right there, I better fix that, because if I don't, he's already got in his mind he could fall and get hurt over there, and it's going to be my fault because he reported it and it didn't get fixed.
Yeah.
So anything that was reported, buddy, we went and took care of it because you didn't want to have that happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it does work in, to some degree, but at the same time, the fact that there is any type of negligence that is comes into play, I don't like the system as much as a traditional workers' compensation system. I think if you get hurt while you're at work, it should be workers' compensation. And I think it should be like that for the railroad, too. I don't think negligence should come into play. I don't know that you're gaining more by changing the system to allow more damages, but I think you're better off just covering everybody without negligence and making it safe.
Well, the problem is, too, it's a very adversarial working conditions. It's an us and them, us being the supervisors and them being the you know, union employees.
Yeah.
And you're all, I mean, when it comes down to it, and I tried to make this argument a few times with guys when I was talking to them, look, we're out here just trying to make a living to feed our families and do the best we can do. We all have the same goal. Just because I'm on this side of the fence and you're on that side of the fence doesn't mean we can't make it easier for each other. But that never went anywhere.
Can't we all just get along?
Yeah, no, you can't. Unfortunately, there's things in life that just don't, that doesn't happen. Whenever you have a labor union and management, it's an adversarial type situation. And, you know, sometimes it's for the good. I mean, obviously by those numbers of how many people were getting slaughtered, something had to be done.
Oh, for and certain.
All those changes were good.
For certain.
The question is, now, do you still need, not necessarily those rules, but do you still need the union to protect you from those things? Are those things still happening?
Well, I think,
you know,
maybe not. I mean, maybe you can move to a more traditional workers' compensation system where negligence doesn't come into play. But I think it's so entrenched at this point, it'll probably never change.
Yeah, I would say so, too. And, you know, the other thing about it is, like I said, there's a whole lot less people working for the railroad. Now, you probably had more in 1920 than you do now.
Yeah. Well, it was probably a bit more labor intensive at that point, whereas one person
right.
can do a lot more with a computer or an app on their phone or something.
Yeah, everything's mechanized. I mean, when I started out, you had all the different yards had dispatchers and chief dispatchers and yard masters and all that. Now you got them all centralized, like for CSX down in Jacksonville, Florida. And you don't have any of these people out in the field anymore.
There's nobody local in the yard?
No, huh? They're all down in Jacksonville, and they tell the crews what to do. Crews report to work, and they tell them what to do.
Yeah, maybe that's safer. I don't know.
Well, you know, when you've only got, what did I say, 9 people that were killed in 2019?
Yeah.
Something's happening correctly. I mean, that's a good thing. Now, there was one injury that I had as a supervisor that, it was one of these things that you just thought, you know, this guy's just snake bit. I was actually over clerks in an office in Baltimore, Maryland. And we had the guys that were called checkers. And that was because they went out and they would check tracks and write down the cars that were in tracks so you could keep track of where certain ones were. There were other spurs where we would check and make sure that cars spotted for customers were put on those spurs where they could unload them and stuff like that. So, of course, the railroad operates 24 hours. They're checking tracks. And, you know, there's, if you've ever been around the railroad is never in the good part of town. It's always in the bad part of town. So if you're going out and checking cars, you're subjecting yourself to being in bad situations. So anyway, this, we knew that this one place we would spot carloads of beer, and it was a warehouse that the beer was unloaded into. So he went out to check to make sure this car had gotten spotted. He rolls up, and this had happened before. Here was two pickup trucks, and guys had broken open the door, and they were throwing the beer out into the pickup trucks. Now, if you encountered, you know, five or six guys in the middle of the night, and you're by yourself, you're not armed, all you got is a pencil and a pad, what do you think the wise thing to do would be?
You walk up to me and say, "All right, guys, I'm taking your names. Get out your pencil and pad and start taking names."
Well, I mean, you would hope the guy would either drive to a payphone, because we didn't have cell phones then, either drive to a payphone and call somebody, or he would just come back and report it. But this guy walked up there and he was like, "Hey, you guys shouldn't be doing that. Get out of there. Come on now. Straighten up."
Listen here, you rascallions.
They took a metal pipe and beat him within an inch of his life.
Oh, my gosh.
The guy was out for 6 months. And it's like, you know, you felt sorry. The guy was a nice guy. But you had to say, this guy did it to himself. Who in their right mind would walk up there and they're going to go, "Oh, excuse me, sir. You caught us here. We'll put the beer back and leave. Please don't report us."
Now, I wonder when he had his hearing if they said, "Well, under Section 347, doesn't it say not to approach anyone stealing cargo off a train?"
Well, there's rules that are in there that you can use. Like there was one that went in there, something about when making your decisions about how you go about without clear instructions, do not put yourself at risk.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, did you put yourself at risk doing this? Well, as it ends up, I guess I'd have to say yes to that. But he came back. They not only beat him in the head, but they broke his arm. So anyway, but this guy, he was a nice guy, like I say, and he wanted to work. So you could come back and work on light duty if you wanted to, which light duty meant you couldn't make them lift things, and there were certain tasks they couldn't do and stuff. So he came back, and he still had one arm in a sling, but he was willing to work. So they said, "Okay, well, we'll have you deliver these." We just had him like, you know, "Can you drive a car?" "Yeah, I drove here. I drove to work." "Okay, well, we'll have you deliver these." There was tickets that had to be delivered to another station or something like that. So he's driving with his one good hand, and he starts turning the wheel, and he's like got the middle portion of the steering wheel like just with his little finger or something like that, and he hits a big pothole, and it pulls that wheel back against his hand and snaps his little finger.
Oh, my gosh.
And so here he is with one broken arm, breaks his finger on the other. He's got to try to drive back to the office like that. So now he's got both arms in a sling because, I mean, it really messed it up bad. We said, "You know, you're not coming back to work till you're completely healed. We can't take it." But the guy was just snake bit. He was just one of those kind of guys that went through life that way.
Always injured.
My favorite guy that worked there, though, he was a guy named Will Hemphill. I'll never forget him. He was about 6'10" and weighed about 290. I mean, the guy was big and just intimidating looking. And he would go out, and I noticed that he always carried two flares in his back pocket. And I'm like, the train crews use flares, but the clerks don't use flares for anything. So I finally asked him one day, I said, "Will, why do you carry those flares in your back pocket?" And he worked nights too. And he said, "Because if I'm out there and anybody comes up to mess with me, they're going to get 6 inches of lit fusee right up the ass." I said, "Anybody that would mess with you has got to be crazy." Because he was a mountain of a man.
He was going to shoot somebody with a flare gun.
Yeah. Well, it was the few, it looked like a stick of dynamite. You know, you've seen those kind of flares.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and you just take off the top and scratch it and it lights.
Yeah.
That was his plan. If anybody ever messed with him, he was going to light it and he was going to stick it where the sun doesn't shine. And he figured they wouldn't mess with him anymore.
Yeah, definitely not the second guy. Second guy sees the first guy get that happening to him. He's like, I'm out of here.
But I've said this many times. I don't know whether the railroad hires characters or creates characters, but I never met as many characters in my life as I did on the railroad.
Well, now, not only, I just want to talk on this quickly, but not only does the railroad have special kinds of different workers' compensation, but there's other kinds of federal workers' compensation out there, too, aside from the different states. One is called the Longshore Act, and that takes care of harbor workers and people that work inside the marinas and shipbuilders and things like that. And that is covered under the federal workers' compensation, kind of similar to that. The other is the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, also known as the Jones Act, and that deals with cabotage, which is a coastwise trade. And it has to do with seamen, so not the people that work in the harbors and things like that, but actual people that are on the boats transferring the goods along the coast or through the rivers and things like that.
Oh, that kind of seamen.
Yes, that kind of seamen. Another interesting is the Defense Base Act, and this is for different civilian employees who are working outside the U.S. on different military bases, and it provides coverage to civilian contractors or people along those lines when they're doing their job on a military base. And then there was one other thing I came across, which I just like the name of. It's called the Death on the High Seas Act, and that's a U.S. admiralty law which was enacted by Congress, which permitted a recovery of damages against a ship owner by a spouse, child, or dependent family member of a seaman killed in international waters. So whereas the Jones Act applies to coastal waters that are kind of near, the Death on the High Seas Act would apply if somebody was more than 12 miles off sea or offshore and then killed. Their family could sue under that. So there's all kinds of different weird federal workers' compensation-like type laws out there. Now, most of these do, in fact, have that similar component of negligence like the FELA has, whereas it's not a guaranteed system like state workers' compensation. There has to be some sort of negligence on behalf of the company or the ship owner or something along those lines. So the Jones Act in particular, I came across some interesting examples of where negligence might be found. So if there's like a deckhand mopping the deck next to a door and doesn't necessarily cordon off the area so it's wet, if another deckhand comes out and slips, then the injured deckhand has a good chance of suing under the Jones Act because the area wasn't properly marked off. There was water there. So something as simple as that can be negligence. Another example would be if the ship owner fails to have the vessel's equipment properly maintained. So say, for example, there was a rusty hatch on the boat and a crew member injured their back trying to open the hatch because it was rusty. Then that could be deemed as negligence too under the Jones Act. So it could be a very kind of minuscule amount of negligence, and they generally hold it to be pretty favorable to the injured worker. So even though there is that standard, it's kind of light.
See, we had a catch-all to cover that, too.
What's that?
Because, like, you know, you could compare opening a hatch to lining a switch on the railroad. So some switches would line very easily. Other switches were hard. I mean, you had to get down and get your shoulder against it and push and everything else to get them over. So there was a lot of people that would claim injuries on trying to line a switch. So they put a little twist in there that said, you're not allowed to throw a switch if it's hard to throw, and that you have to use your own judgment. If you line it and you hurt yourself, you know, you have to use your own judgment as to whether it's safe to throw or not. So that way, if you threw it and you hurt yourself, you couldn't say it was hard to throw, because if it was hard to throw, you shouldn't have thrown it.
What happens if the switch doesn't get thrown? Then you get in trouble for not throwing it.
Well, you report it and say, look, I can't go this way. You have to find a different way for me to go, or else get somebody from the engineering department out here to fix this switch.
That's interesting. The railroad really covered all their bases there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I say. There's a gotcha for anything you can think of. If you when you're maintaining radio contact and you're, say, you're controlling a movement, you're the guy on the ground and you're talking to the engineer, and when you make a movement, you do it by car lengths. So you'd say, okay, 10 cars to a coupling. And then you keep backing them up, 5 cars to a coupling, 2 cars, 1 car, half a car, that'll do. And you do it that way. Well, if the person gives you 10 cars and you don't hear for them by the time you reached 5 cars, you stop. If you continue and then you end up causing an accident, it's your fault you didn't stop because you were supposed to stop after 5 cars if the last command you got was 10 cars.
Yeah.
So they have all these catch-alls that they've gone through. And I mean, the rule book is extremely thick and it covers everything. And I feel like a lot of that is to throw off, to try to refute the negligence.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's part of the law there, I guess, because they want to try to have some sort of out from it, not just cover everybody.
Right.
So, well, I think that's going to bring us to
legal briefs.
So legal briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different quiz type questions to see if he knows the law.
No, I don't. So I know more than I did 4 years ago, though.
So, well, that's good. I'd like to think I do, too. So what does FELA, the Longshore Act, the Jones Act, and the Defensive Base Act have in common?
That they have that clause about negligence involved in them, and that you can get awards for things beyond just your hospital bills and lost time.
That's true. I wasn't actually thinking about that. So they're all federal laws.
Federal laws, yeah. Yes.
So what do they have in common that allows them to be federal laws?
That they all are based under the Commerce Clause.
That's right. The Commerce Clause. If it's nothing else that you've learned in 4 years, the federal government uses the Commerce Clause quite a bit.
Yeah, instead of ho, 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 he says cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Because if you think about it, the railroads, that deals with interstate commerce. The Merchant Marine Act of 1920 deals with shipping cargo to and from.
The Davy Jones's locker.
That's right. And it, actually, that's what I thought it was going to be for Davy Jones, but it's actually not Davy Jones. It's named for the congressperson, Senator Wesley Jones, that introduced the law. So just a coincidence. Okay. What is cabotage? Or cabotage.
Cabotage, that's what happens up and down the shore or something like that, you said.
That's right. It's coastwise trade. I think you knew that one was going to be coming into question when I said it.
Well, that word just stuck with me, and I meant to ask you about it at the time, and I forgot. But I remember it had something to do with what you did going up and down the shore.
Yeah, and it has to do with coastwise trade. So, again, dealing with interstate commerce. Now, the other interesting thing that I didn't touch on, and I'm looking at my notes here, is we're talking about the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 and the Jones Act in general, is that it prohibits foreign vessels from transporting U.S. goods from port to port. So, for example, a foreign ship could not transfer goods intended from one U.S. port to the other U.S. port just simply along the coastline. And it's been kind of argued that it's very protectionist, that it keeps the open market from lowering costs and things like that. But I think it does serve a bit of a dual purpose, because it keeps the workers a bit safer, because under U.S. regulations that these U.S. owned ships have to have certain kinds of insurances and things like that, whereas it'd be harder for an injured worker to recover if it was a possible, foreign country's ship. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably inherently a good thing if we have all these vessels going up and down our coast that they're domestic.
Well, it could be a way to circumvent the law, too.
Yeah.
Because if they were all from other countries, it'd be hard to enforce our federal regulations on people from other countries as far as injuries and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I just said. Maybe not so articulately, but that's what I was trying to say. So, but yeah, this is it. Workers' compensation, as you mentioned earlier, this is kind of my final thought about it, was it's statewide, it deals without negligence. Negligence is not an issue. If you get hurt, you get compensated for your injuries, usually by lost mm-hmm. wages and medical bills. For these other different kinds of federal workers' compensation type acts, the negligence does come into play, but you can recover a bit more. So there's trade-offs for each and the other. I think In my experience, I think the statewide workers' compensation is probably a better protection for the workers because you don't have to worry about all these different weird negligence laws. That's just my opinion. Hmm. But I've never really dealt with any federal workers' compensation claims, only statewide ones. So that's my experience, but which I guess I kind of prefer.
Now, I've got one legal brief for you.
Okay.
And it's actually a three-part question.
Okay. Hopefully I can get this one.
The railroads were highly regulated up until 1980 or 82. And like everything, like even what they charged to move freight was dictated by the government. The government would put out a large book of tariffs, mm-hmm. and that's what the railroads had to charge. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1980 or 82, the railroads were deregulated. Do you know what the name of the act was that deregulated the railroads?
Hmm. I do not.
It was the Staggers Act.
The Staggers and do Act? You,
yeah, and do you know who Staggers was?
I do not.
He was a senator named Harley O. Staggers.
Harley O. Staggers. That's a great name.
And you know where he was from?
West Virginia?
You are correct.
that was just a guess, but
yeah. That's the Staggers Act. He was Harley Staggers. It was one of the last things he did. I think that was the last year he was in, and he had introduced that law, and they passed it, and that deregulated the railroads. So now the railroads, that made them more competitive, because instead of just petitioning the government to increase their rates, now they had to actually perform. And that's when they started looking at cutting crews. They had no incentive to become better and utilize technology and reduce train crews, because they could charge whatever the government would let them charge.
The invisible hand of the market stepped in and fixed things.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. It's kind of a...
Yeah. You know, I came across something that I wanted to share, though.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of things with this pandemic and stuff that we've just come to accept now that it's gone on for the last 3 years. And we just seem to, you know, we're used to these things. Like now, when I see a TV show and people aren't wearing a mask, I'm like, what's wrong with those people?
Right.
Because I expect to see that.
Or if I see somebody wearing a mask, I'm like, oh, this must be recent.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things you accept. Well, other generations with their own things that have gone on, it's the same way. And it's kind of this. I've got these trivia calendars on my desk. One is a sports one, and one is just kind of a general unsolved mysteries one. But this one hit me, and this was one of those things where you just get used to what's going on in your life. So in the, you know, of course, in the UK during World War II in England, they were under constant bombing from the Germans,
right?
Every night. And so it was interrupting their life. They had to change what they were doing because of this bombing. So, you know, you would think you'd just give up on certain things, but here was... These six rules were posted at the golfing club there in England, that this one golfing club, temporary rules for 1940 because of the bombing that was taking place. So these are just, if you're going to go out and have your round of golf, you know, while we're getting bombed, these are some rules that will help you out through. So these things must have come up or they wouldn't have bothered discussing them.
Right.
So number one, players are asked to collect bombs and shrapnel to save causing damage to the mowing machines. Number two, in competitions during gunfire, players may take cover without incurring a penalty for ceasing playing. Number three, the positions of known delayed action bombs are marked with red flags. Number four, shrapnel may be moved on the fairway or in the bunkers without penalty. Number five, a ball moved or destroyed by enemy action can be replaced without penalty, provided it's not near the hole. And last one, number six, a player whose stroke is affected by a bomb exploding may play another ball from the same place, but there is a one-stroke penalty.
Oh, it's a one-stroke penalty. That's it, huh?
Yeah, so if a bomb goes off while you're hitting your ball, you can play it again from that same spot, but you can't you get a one-stroke penalty.
I will tell you, I am not an avid golfer, but I've played my fair share of rounds of golf, and I have friends that play golf, and we play competitively and, you know, make sure nobody cheats and we count all the strokes because we, you know, we try to see who wins. Even in that, I don't think anybody would, if there are bombs going off, I don't think they'd be like, no, that's a one-stroke penalty. I think we would.
Hey, the English take their golf seriously.
I guess so.
I just found that, you know, we think we have it bad sometimes, some of our inconveniences. And then you look at that generation in 1940, and they wanted to go ahead and enjoy their golf, and these were the few things that they changed to be able to go do it. It amazed me. It's, you know, wearing a mask now is such a big ask.
Yeah.
And these guys were out there, oh, yeah, it's all right if you have slow play because you're taking gunfire every now and then.
It's acceptable.
What have we gotten to?
I don't know.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is the Galactic Federation. I know. The what? I am just as surprised saying that statement as you are hearing it. I came across what is, as best as I could determine, a legitimate article written about an Israeli space security chief that said, Earthlings have been in contact with extraterrestrials from a Galactic Federation. Ordinarily, I would have quit reading at this point, but it is 2020, and all kinds of unbelievably crazy stuff and stupid stuff has actually happened. So I guess it should not really be a surprise. Just one more 2020 hates us moment. The guy's name is Chaim Eshed, and he is the former head of Israel's Defense Ministry's Space Directorate. He is stated to be a noted and respected Israeli scientist. I don't know if he really is, because I don't usually keep up with those things, or they don't list nations' respected scientists on like baseball cards or something, so we could check out his rookie card and see if it's true. He said the unidentified flying objects have asked to not publish that they are here because they don't think humanity is quite ready yet. But soon, Eshed, who is listed not only as a respected professor but also a retired general, said the aliens are equally curious about humanity and were seeking to understand the fabric of the universe. Eshed further stated that an agreement was signed between the U.S. government and the aliens. This agreement includes developing a joint base underground on Mars and for them to perform some experiments here. He said Trump knows about them and he wanted to tell everyone, but the other national leaders asked him not to, as well as the representatives from the Galactic Federation, to avoid mass hysteria. But that is the impetus for Trump to have started the Space Force. Now, these are my concerns. A Galactic Federation implies more than one other planet is on their team. I mean, you don't have a federation with just one member, so they are able to get more than one planet together, and we can't even get one country on one planet together. Between that and the fact they were able to find us in outer space, and all we have ever found is rocks, means that they are vastly more intelligent than us. Then, on top of all that, they have met Trump, and they think he is our leader, our superior, and that we are all like him. They had to have gone back home saying, like, dudes, this is going to be so much easier than we thought. Forget about the sonic blaster. We'll just march in backwards and they'll think we're leaving. We'll just tell Trump he won our election and he'll climb on board to fly back and we'll just float him once we leave Earth's atmosphere. Part of me says, look, if they have been observing 2020, they probably wouldn't want any part of this planet. At least I hope. Supposedly, they've been waiting until we could understand, and they are starting with our leaders because they are capable of handling it, but the general population is not quite ready. But it will be soon. I don't know if that will ever be true. We would just screw up space the same way we have screwed up our own planet. There may be one clue as to the whole revelation, however. No matter how sincere Mr. Ishid is, he did just recently write and release a book. So maybe that has something to do with why this notable and respected scientist and general suddenly feels the need to pass on this information. I just hope this contract we signed with the Galactic Federation has a clause in there about not destroying all of humanity. I mean, that seems like a reasonable ask, right? Because if there is one thing I've learned from Court Appointed, a contract is a contract, even if it is signed with a nanu nanu. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.